Welcome to G.L. Horton's Stage Page. It's Sunday, the 8th of October, 2006. Today we have a salon-style discussion between Larry Stark of TheaterMirror.com and Geraldine Horton of StagePage.info. While the discussion centers on a local production of Claire Booth Luce's play, Women, it ranges out in several directions from that solid core.
Day before yesterday, we attended an extraordinary event. Our excellent small theater in Boston, Speakeasy Theater Company, presented a play by a woman with 20 women in it.
And no men.
And no men. A play by a woman is remarkable enough. A play with 20 actresses in it is nearly a once-in-a-lifetime event, which I wish, of course, it wasn't, since I've written the play with 20 actresses in it.
Yes.
And you've seen other productions of this, right, besides
one.
The Speakeasy.
I have never seen the film. I'm curious about the film, but that's irrelevant to the fact that I did see a production at Footlight Club. And other people, other community theaters have been doing it, I think because they have realized that they have an awful lot of actresses and they don't use enough of them.
And so, they certainly get to use
exactly
a major stable full here. This play, I don't think, has ever quite disappeared from the community theater roster.
Even though it was written in
1936, first produced, I guess, in 1937.
And what was the title of this play?
The Women, by Claire Booth Luce.
Right. Thank you. This particular production is very rich, and I think, oddly enough, abstract. There's a very interesting set, which looks sort of, to me, looked sort of glacial.
I thought it looked a little like a battleship or a cruise ship. That is, everything is kind of basic battleship gray.
Yeah.
It's very functionally ordered, and it seems to have decks. As the way the levels work.
All right, yes. There are columns, and then there is a section that can be curtained off with a round curtain.
Which most notably serves as a dressing room in a very fashionable designer's shop.
And a bathroom in which a lady has a telephone so that she can talk to her lover without her husband knowing.
Uh-huh. Meanwhile, she's in a bubble bath up
right
to her neck, with her shapely legs sticking out over the side.
Yes.
You said the production was very rich, which of course is appropriate, because it's about the very rich.
Yes.
The very rich at a time when their condition was in great contrast to the condition of the rest of the people in the country.
Well, these women have more time and money on their hands than they know what to do with.
They do, but it mostly is not their money.
True. Oh, yes. That's a good reason why they got married in the first place, and why when they find out that their husbands are dallying, shall we say, with younger ladies, they divorce in a way to hang on to the money. There's one lady who is very good at that, as a matter of fact, which is the Countess.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had the feeling that the Countess only really prospered from the very first divorce that she had.
Yes.
I thought the other divorces were either so-so, or perhaps she had to contribute to the exit of the gentleman in question.
Well, she does mention that the one that she picks up while she's divorcing in Reno, she picks up a cowboy, explaining that she can take him to Hollywood and make him a star, which she does. But she does it, I'm sure, by backing three or four movies with her money.
It seems to happen a little faster than that.
Yes.
The time frame of the play is only, I think, 2 years. But she does that, of course, gives him economic independence, and then he can do what a wise chorus girl on the upward swing can do, which is get rid of the sugar parent and acquire the person that he's really interested in.
Oddly enough, as far as I can tell, none of these ladies really marry one man and stay married to him forever, except the one who is always pregnant.
No, that's not the case. The bottom line for judging the state of this relationship, and that basically, I guess, is what the play is about, the relationships that are available and the compromises people make to either stay in them or to get out of them with their dignity and their finances intact, it belongs to the mother of the heroine, Mary's mom,
yes,
who presumably is old money. And came into the marriage.
She's
and
dressed
could
that
have
way.
Gone out of the marriage with her own assets if she had decided to divorce her husband when he strayed. Mm-hmm. But she does not. She says that's the nature of men, and then she did not doubt that his major commitment was to her and to his family, and she just, her advice was to ride it out. He'll come back.
Yes. It's interesting that I just realized that that's the situation about father in the Philadelphia story.
Mm-hmm.
He's not there because he is dallying with another woman, but wife will not divorce him.
And she expects him.
And she expects him to come back, and I think he probably does after the end of the Philadelphia story.
Well, he shows up at the end. The question is, what is his status?
Exactly.
Yes.
Yes.
His daughter is the one who's mad at him.
Ah, I hadn't realized. Yes, yes, yes.
Well, we're talking about the sociology of male-female marriages here instead of about the play itself. And I suppose that's because it's very interesting in terms of gossip.
Yes.
And in terms of the perspective that it gets on where we are sociologically with marriage today. And I remarked to somebody on the way out of the theater that I think this play probably plays a little differently now here in Boston, where of all the surprising things, not only do we have a very high proportion of women employed and independent, we also have the lowest divorce rate in the country.
Oh.
So is this the basis that Bostonians just are not subject to the kind of temptations, or is that we have somehow developed a European attitude towards preserving marriage in spite of the human tendency to stray?
Is it possible that in Boston men don't stray?
That was a question. I suppose it is possible. Is it likely?
You're suggesting that the women have a different attitude towards straying.
Well, it's hard to tell, isn't it? What do we know about people's attitudes? Well, we judge by the actions of our friends. We judge by what we read in the psychology books. We judge by statistics and what we see in the movies. And we judge by plays and television, most of which are written by men. So it's really nice to have an opportunity to see what Claire Booth loose thought she saw in the circle that she moved in, and she moved in a pretty wide circle since she was born, as the program says, a bastard child of a chorus girl.
Oh.
And married her way up and was called at one point the most successful courtesan of the 20th century, even though she was married for 30 years to an extremely respectable person, Mr. Luce, who was the publisher of Time magazine.
Well, she was editor of a magazine, too.
Uh-huh.
Which means they had something in common. As a matter of fact, what magazine was she editing?
You want me to look it up in the program. I think it was Vanity Fair. Let me check.
Yes, I'm sure it was. Which was a very with-it magazine at the time.
Oh, yes.
Socially, that, and certainly famous for his covers of the nasty sort of cartoonish.
Now, the only responses to this I've seen so far is yours in the Theater Mirror and Louise Kennedy's in the Globe. And I must say that I was very pleased that the Globe has a female critic to send to this show. Because seeing her response to the various attitudes of the various women, and we haven't even mentioned all the maids and shop girls and the cook who are in it, made me conscious of that one of the things she seems to say in her review is that this is an interesting piece. It will be exhilarating for women to see it. And she is advising that they do. And, you know, I can't remember any time when I've seen a criticism piece in the Globe, or mostly not very many other places, where it has acknowledged the fact that women are a significant portion of the theater audience, and in fact, the majority of the theater audience. And it might be a good idea to say whether a particular play was likely to be of interest to women.
The contrast I found with the two productions, I thought that the people at the Footlight Club made everyone considerably more human, and Scott Edmiston as director made them clothes horses and tended to make them more presentational than realistic.
It did look like the Vanity Fair photo spread version of their lives.
Costumes are gorgeous.
The costumes are gorgeous.
And the ladies inside them tend to look gorgeous.
And they move beautifully.
Yes.
It's choreographed and with a certain sense of being overlooked. But that certainly doesn't extend to the lower level servants.
Oh yes, and they can be vitriolic.
But it does
in their comments,
give
I
you.
Say.
I think it's probably a perfectly valid take on the play because these are people who live in the glare of publicity. If you're seen with somebody else's husband, it makes the gossip columns the next day. One of the reasons that the question of the heroine divorcing her husband is central is because everybody knows she can't forgive him without humiliating herself publicly
yes.
by taking him back. Well, all her girlfriends plus the gossip columns are just eager for it to develop into a major crisis and result in something dramatic.
And eventually, apparently, at the end of this play, she is marching off to get him back. Because he happens to be the person she wants to be married to.
Because she loves him. So, if you're comparing, you said the Footlighter production, the community theater production, the oldest community theater in the United States,
exactly.
in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, that you saw it at, seemed more human. Now, did you like the play better when you saw it there? Or did you like it differently?
That's impossible to say because I'm seeing it a second time.
I see.
It makes a difference to me when I know what's going on and can compare rather than discovering what is going on in each part as it comes to me. So I also try not to judge as much as possible. I mean, so if you're seeing it a second time, then you're comparing automatically.
Well, this is certainly a play worth seeing a second time. I'm almost tempted to go back because with the 20 women, you cannot tell all the things that are going on in in the larger scenes. There are just too many people to
yes.
watch at once.
Exactly.
And it's so detailed and the acting is so splendid that you want to go back and see what those people who were sort of on the wrong side of the stage.
It is true also that in the act break I said to Scott Edmondson, you have put on stage all the women I am in love with. I'm speaking of people with equity cards.
But this is not an entirely equity show. It's about two-thirds non-equity, and I was sort of slapping myself for not going down auditioning for it. It looked like they were having a wonderful time.
You could play Maggie.
I thought there were two or three smaller roles that I
yes,
might be
I
able
know,
to play.
Yes, I know, but the Maggie we saw, you could play.
She was wonderful. I should mention her name.
Maggie is a cook. She sits and she listens to a chambermaid telling her, rather poignantly, about what she heard when the husband left the house for good. And she does that listening and belting down Jim Beam. Because at that time, both of these ladies would have been Irish.
Well, and then
because they're servants.
And then she delivers her opinion on these matters, which is not quite the sympathetic opinion
yes,
of,
exactly.
of the upper-level maid. Anyway, that Maggie is Sandra Heflin.
Yes.
Her Irish cook is just magnificent.
And it's a small part. You've got to remember we're talking about.
This is actually my first stage of the women that I've seen. Of course, I read it early on, as I try to read every play by women I ever hear of, and I saw the PBS roundabout video of the roundabout production.
Oh, I didn't know that's what it was.
Uh-huh.
In that case, I would try to find it if I could.
Very stylish. I mean, not only the costumes, but the set is pretty amazing.
Well, one of the interesting...
I like the more neutral
totally
set,
irrelevant
actually.
Details about this production is that the ladies phone or get phone calls frequently, and yet the phone... is never connected to anything. There's no wire leading away from the phone. The maid brings the phone in and says, you have a call, and hands it to the person. And yet there's nothing.
You're not supposed to think about that, Larry. I didn't think about it. That's abstraction. You know, the central figure comes forward, and the details sort of blend into that gray neutral background that the designer has so carefully put there on what we're supposed to see.
We also ought to mention that the author, I'm sure, intended one character who calls herself a virgin because she's never been married as her mouthpiece.
Spinster. Isn't she a spinster?
She uses the word virgin.
Oh, I guess I missed that.
Yes. And this part is played by Nancy Carroll, who starts it, and I don't know whether this is in the script, by reading...
The stage directions
to set the scene. And then she walks into the set and proceeds to torpedo every lady on stage with a quip that is so fast and so apt and so snappy that you referred to her as a Dorothy Parker lookalike.
No, that was Will
who referred to her as a Dorothy Parker lookalike. Okay.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying it was Will Stackman's observation. Yes.
But, you know, what she does is capsulize a reaction to whatever is going on in three or four words that are apt, interesting, funny, and draw blood. Just about every single time.
Well, this is a formidable lady, the author of this play.
Yes.
It's another amazing thing is that it was written in 3 days. And the quote from her in the program says, "Because I am a woman, I must make unusual efforts to succeed. If I fail, no one would say, 'She doesn't have what it takes.' They will say, 'Women don't have what it takes.'"
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it as much as they did. And if you did, we hope you'll tell a friend about us, or subscribe to our show, or possibly even vote for it out on Podcast Alley, where you can find it listed in the cultural political category. Until next week.